fine presentations, and the case will be taken under advisement. The next case this morning is number 023578, the United States against Theodore Rodgers. Mr. McGowan.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Andrew J. McGowan, and I'm with the Federal Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. With me at counsel table is Heather Wakefield and Luke Kasten. Heather Wakefield will be representing Mr. Rodgers, and I am representing Mr. Owens. We are going to be splitting up our time in this case because the issues are entirely different in these two cases. I will be taking 5 minutes, and Ms. Wakefield will be taking 3. In Mr. Owens' appeal, he appeals 2 issues, one of which is the denial of the motion to suppress and identification. The second issue is the sufficiency of evidence argument. Unless there are questions about the sufficiency of the evidence argument, I intend to spend my time talking about the identification issue. In this case, Mr. Theodore Rodgers identified Mr. Owens for the first time when they were both placed in a cell, 3 weeks after Mr. Rodgers was shown pictures of Mr. Owens by agents.
Does the record show how many people were in that cell? Were they the only two there, or were there other, was that a big pen?
Your Honor, I believe the record's pretty clear that there were only 2 defendants in there. However, it does appear as though there was a probation officer asking questions of Mr. Owens at the time. And that would be based on Mr. Owens' initial appearance, I believe.
Right. I mean, the reason I wonder is only because, while I certainly would be cautious about attaching any weight to intent, if a random person comes into a cell and another person is there, they might or might not have any association with person number 2 who comes in. And that seems to be what happened, you know. I guess your theory is sort of the psychological one, that here is this array of photographs, you know, a face gets stuck in somebody's mind, even though nobody, as far as I know, highlighted Mr. Owens in the photograph display. Is that right?
Your Honor, one of the problems with this case is that we don't have a lot of information about what happened at various aspects of the points at issue. The first problem we have is we don't have what happened when the agent showed him photographs.
We don't know how many.
We don't know if it was a lineup. We don't know how many. We don't know how many of Mr. Owens he was shown. It's just not in the record. And so all we know is
that... What burden was it to make the record on that?
Well, the initial burden would be on the defense. This motion was made during trial. There were a lot of aspects of this that I would have done differently had I been trial counsel. Well, I was not. But it was made sufficiently for the district court to actually rule on it. And, of course, the district court could have said it was out of time. However, the district court did not and wrote a very thoughtful opinion about not only this motion but other motions that were made during trial and the motion after trial for judgment of acquittal. But so to answer the court's question, I don't know how many pictures of Mr. Owens, how specific it was, if it was highlighted, if the pictures were, you know, 8x10 glossy. I don't know what the pictures look like. But we do know that he was shown a picture of Mr. Owens at a very important time in his prosecution. He had been charged, he knew he was facing federal time, and he knew the only way he was going to get out of this was to cooperate. Agents come and see him under those circumstances, and they show him a picture. I think he's going to remember what that picture looks like 3 weeks later when he's put in the same cell with one other person.
And the district judge gave you the benefit of the doubt on that. The district judge said it was unduly suggestive and then moved on to the bigger factor.
I believe the district court did, although it wasn't as clear as I would have liked.
But he certainly now, he analyzes the bigger factors.
Yes, he did. He analyzed the bigger factors, and I disagree with his analysis for a number of reasons. And I think the most important factors that I think that this court may have misconstrued were the time elements. The 10 to 11 month difference between when he identified Mr. Owens and when he was first arrested in this case, it's a long time, and in fact, in Biggers itself, it indicates that a victim of a rape who has 7 months between the identification, that would be a significant problem. In this case, he's not a victim of a rape, he's just sort of there, and in fact, he's not paying much attention to what's going on in the first place. He's hungry.
He's eating the burger.
They arrive at a parking lot, and he gets out of the car and goes get something to eat. And this person's not particularly attentive to the kind of things that you would expect somebody to be able to identify somebody with. He had trouble identifying Mr. Owens, distinguishing him at trial between him and his attorney. And in fact, made the unremarkable comment, and I believe Mr. Rogers is an African-American, that most black guys look alike in response to a question about what the person in the car that Mr. Owens allegedly enters looked like. So here's a person who's not very attentive at the time, not terribly interested in what's going on, but 10 months later can identify Mr. Owens. I think the whole process is not only overly suggestive, but the factors, when the court's looked at it, including the factor that Mr. Owens is not a victim, or Mr. Rogers is not a victim, he's a snitch, would lead this court to disagree with the district court. If there are no further questions at this time, I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGowan. Ms. Wakefield.
Hey, please, the court. My name is Luke Kess, and I'm appointed counsel, private counsel, Your Honor. Ms. Wakefield will be handling this argument. It is her first.
I noticed that Ms. Wakefield has not filed a certificate of interest in the case. Ms. Wakefield, if you would be so kind as to do that at the clerk's office before leaving, we would appreciate it.
Okay.
Are you associated with the same firm as the sponsor?
Yes.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Fine. If you would please see that certificate is filed before you leave today, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Good morning. The issue before you this morning is whether or not the district court erred in denying Rogers' motion to vacate his plea agreement. Specifically, the district court erred in finding that Trooper Carmen was a credible witness and that Rogers gave consent to search his vehicle, and as a result, finding that the underlying motion to suppress lacked sufficient merit. Trooper Carmen testified that he was traveling behind a pack of vehicles for about 5 miles before he noticed a vehicle cross the fog line. Now, Trooper Carmen testified he was on the inside lane. He was driving, so he was on the left side of the car. Rogers was on the outside lane, traveling 4 or 5 cars ahead of him. It would have been very difficult for Trooper Carmen to have actually seen this occur, especially...
Is it illegal to cross the fog line?
It is. However, I think that it would be very difficult for Trooper Carmen to have actually seen what he claims he saw.
I know it's illegal to cross the center line, but I didn't know whether it's illegal to cross the fog line as well.
You must stay in your lane. You must use proper lane usage. So
if it is illegal, under Wren, the trooper has the ability to make the arrest, to make the traffic stop, if you will.
That's correct.
And it's up to the district judge to decide credibility matters. And I think most importantly, your assumption is that a meritorious suppression motion would have been grounds to set aside the plea agreement, but the judge inquired about the various prerequisites for taking a plea at the time, and one waives things like Fourth Amendment, potentially good even, Fourth Amendment rights when a plea is taken and the plea is made voluntarily and so forth. I'm not sure how far we can go with this idea that maybe if he'd stuck with it, he would have had a possible Fourth Amendment claim.
Well, Your Honor, all this was going on without having the hearing on the motion to suppress. So as far as Rogers knew, at the time when this was going on, everything was getting in.
Well, but he told the judge he was pleading guilty in a voluntary way, and there are all kinds of things that you might have a shot at if you go to trial. Maybe motions to suppress, maybe other kinds of defenses you might make, but you give them up when you plead. And that's why I think the district court judge focuses on the integrity of the plea process as opposed to, I mean, he sort of, as an aside, looks at the Fourth Amendment. But if the plea is a valid plea, that's it, isn't it?
Well, I think that in this case, the court should have ruled on the motion to suppress before going further into it. It was almost as if the court was jumping ahead a few steps instead of handling things in the order that they came up.
Why should it have done that if the defendant wanted to waive that defense?
I'm sorry, can you
repeat? Why should the court have reached the Fourth Amendment motion, the suppression motion, if the defendant wanted to waive that defense?
Well, the motion to suppress came up months before all this happened, and nothing was going on.
And there's no reservation in the plea for this. Well, I mean, it's just intersecting this argument with a plea agreement and a withdrawal of plea is a difficult thing, given that valid plea agreements waive pretty much everything.
Understandable. However, in this case, it seems that the district court didn't exactly examine closely what Trooper Carman was saying. He simply believed Trooper Carman, it seems, based on the fact that he was a police officer, and there are a lot of things in this case that it seems very unbelievable that these things would have happened exactly as they occurred. It seems almost impossible in numerous situations, especially on the consent issue, because surprisingly, the videotape on the police vehicle ran out at the exact point when Rogers was supposedly giving consent. This is almost too coincidental for it to really be true, considering that Trooper Carman says that consent was given and Rogers says that oral consent was not given. This problem could have been solved had the videotape actually been running, and it just seems very odd and coincidental that this tape ran out just as that was occurring. And as a result, the district court should have looked closer into that. It seems that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear now from Mr. Lanter.
May it please the court. My name is Dean Lanter, and I represent the government in this case. First, concerning the matter of Mr. Rogers' identification of Mr. Owens, the government's position that, first of all, the identification procedures were not unduly suggestive. The first one being the time when the agents showed various photographs to Mr. Rogers in either late September or early October.
And he could not identify the...
That's correct. That's correct.
But the problem is the record, really, because certainly if he had been presented with two photographs, which at least gets us up to the plural, and then he sees one of those two faces 3 weeks later, there's an implicit suggestion that one of the two faces you looked at is the individual, and now you see one of them walk in the room, that could be quite suggestive. If he's shown a maybe more typical array of five or six or some larger number of photographs, the odds start to decrease. We don't know anything about this photo display. And besides, the other thing we don't know is what if one photograph is of an African-American and the other is of a Hispanic person or something. We don't know how different they are. We know nothing.
That's absolutely correct. And there is a significant problem with the record on that issue. What we do know about the fact is that Mr. Rogers didn't pick anyone out of those photographs, and there's no indication in the record that the agents, after he couldn't pick anyone out, affirmatively said that's the person we're looking for.
But I suppose the concern with suggestiveness that the district court also seems to have had is that once the entire span of humanity has been narrowed down to four faces, I'll assume for the sake of argument maybe there were four pictures, it's not so hard to remember four faces. And then 3 weeks later, if one of those four people walks into your cell, it's a criminal context, if you will. It's not like you ran into that person in the grocery store. There's an accusatory air if somebody's walking into a holding cell. You could jump to the conclusion, oh, well, it was that one. And that's, of course, not right. We don't want that.
Correct. At the same time, a couple weeks later, when Mr. Owens and Mr. Rogers were placed in the same cell, there was no suggestion by anyone that Mr. Owens was about to see the person that he had seen previously. Case law is clear that just because a person has previously shown photo arrays or pictures of individuals and can't identify the person out of those pictures and then later makes an identification, whether in a lineup, that in itself isn't unduly suggestive. I understand the problem with the record in this case is we don't know exactly what happened. in that first situation.
What do we know about the encounter in the cell? What kind of a reaction did the witness have to?
I believe the record indicates that immediately upon seeing Mr. Rogers or Mr. Owens in the cell, Mr. Rogers recognized him as the individual that was involved in the parking lot about a year earlier. The record does indicate that it was an immediate recognition by him. The record also indicates why the recognition occurred then when it didn't occur earlier. At trial, Mr. Rogers testified that the reason why I couldn't identify him in the pictures and I could in the cell was because of his physical features beyond his face.
Well, because there was something wrong with the pictures, which we've never seen. Right? I mean, the
correct,
pictures were blurry,
right,
or whatever it was, the wrong
they were
angle
blurry,
or
they didn't show enough of the individual in that regard. Judge Moody, in this case, I believe, gave the defense the benefit of the doubt, or at least did not want to decide the initial issue of whether or not the show-up was unduly suggestive. It's the government's position that it wasn't a show-up that occurred in the second case, and that neither procedure was unduly suggestive. Just placing someone in a jail cell with someone else without any suggestion that you're about to see someone who might be the person you saw.
It wasn't a show-up because nobody said, is this the person?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, it's less suggestive than the cases where a person is a victim of crime is told, go down to the police station, we've arrested someone that might be the one, and then they're sitting in the police station and they see happenstance that person walking by. But even assuming...
Why was everybody there that day? What was going on?
Well, Mr. Owens was there for his initial appearance. The government had been trying to arrest him for about a week, and he was in that cell for his initial appearance.
What was Mr. Rogers around for?
He was in there for his plea hearing. And the record...
On this matter?
Right, on the exact same matter. Pure coincidence, the government had attempted to make sure that they wouldn't be placed in the same cell.
So not only do they recognize each other, fancy meeting you here, I wonder what this party's all about.
Yes. But that's why each of them were there on that day. The government's position is that even assuming that...
It was a reunion from the parking lot, right?
Correct. And it was the next time that they saw each other in person. But even assuming that second situation was unduly suggestive, the government does not believe that Judge Moody erred in finding that under the totality of the circumstances, the in-court identification was...
Yeah, that's a wonderful phrase, the totality of the circumstances. You know, and we have this list in bigger, form these factors. If you notice,
right,
Judge Moody kind of goes with those factors in his opinion. I mean, he doesn't want to talk about each one of those factors very much and very specifically. Can you do that for us?
Well, yes, I can, Your Honor.
Maybe you can do a better job than Judge Moody did.
Judge Moody, I think, did an okay job. He could have been more expansive in his findings, but again, I don't believe, the government doesn't believe that he erred. But just briefly, one of the factors is that Rogers had ample time to view Owens in the parking lot. He saw him twice during broad daylight in a time span of about 25 minutes. He saw him when the Owens vehicle first arrived. He saw him approximately 25 minutes later, and he got a good enough look at him to be able to tell that there was another individual in the car that Mr. Owens was getting back into, and that vehicle was a Lexus. Mr. McGowan indicated that Mr. Rogers wasn't a victim of crime. However, the government submits that he was involved in illegal activity that day, and that people that are involved in committing crimes are going to be more attentive to their surroundings in general, in some cases, than just your ordinary citizen. Possibly not as attentive as a victim of crime while it's occurring, but people that are engaged...
That really is an analogy that lives, isn't it? I mean, it may very well be that this guy would... He didn't want to know what this other fellow was up to any more than he had to. You ever hear the ostrich instruction?
Yes, Your Honor, and it could be that he didn't want to know too much, but I would submit that he wanted to know enough to make sure that the police didn't arrive or that he wasn't caught up in this or that there wasn't some danger to him.
He took that by going to McDonald's, right?
What's that?
He took care of that by going to McDonald's.
Yes, he did. I mean, he...
Burger King, wasn't it?
Burger King?
He got out of the way to a certain extent. Judge Moody also stressed that Mr. Rogers was no longer under the influence of cocaine. At this time, it had been a long time, at least 7 hours earlier.
I have to say, that I found kind of amusing, because we don't know how much he'd snorted, and...
Well, it was, I mean, it was...
Damning with faint praise, is what I thought.
It was
It's an accurate ID, because the guy hadn't snorted cocaine in 7 full hours.
Well, it detracts from the argument that he was too incapacitated from the cocaine to make an identification. Certainly, ideally, you want someone who hasn't been snorting cocaine ever to make the identification, but he hadn't done it recently. Next, he had a high level of certainty, Rogers did, when he saw Owens in the cell. It was an immediate identification of Owens. He didn't have to look at him for a long period of time or anything to that extent. And finally, Judge Moody relied on that the in-court identification was bolstered by the fact that Mr. Rogers was still able to identify Owens despite the fact that his appearance had changed.
How important is this identification to the government's case? Are you making any kind of harmless error argument, or do you concede that without this identification, you wouldn't have enough?
Yes, the government, without this identification, the government concedes that this error would not be harmless, so that without a proper identification, for instance, if the identification was suppressed, the government would not have the sufficiency of the evidence argument of the government would fail if it were not for Mr. Rogers' identification. But again, the government believes that, first of all, none of the identification procedures were unduly suggestive. And with that, I see my time is up.
Can I ask a question on the other variant about this?
Yes, Your Honor.
The search and so forth. Do you agree with this, that the crossing the fog line is illegal under, Indiana law?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. It would be an unsafe lane movement, and it would also be, while not in itself driving while intoxicated, it would at least be an indication that a person might be operating while intoxicated. But the short answer is yes, crossing the lane itself, the fog line, would be a traffic violation.
Thank you, Mr. Lander. You have 1 minute. Thank you, Mr. McGowan. Ms. Wakefield, you serve by appointment of the court. You have the deep thanks of the court for your